Okay, this is the 8 o'clock hour, Sunday night, in which this happy crew of people gets together and compares their curiosity items on the technical net. Main purpose of the technical net is education. We curious people realize that there's a whole lot of different facets, a whole lot of different details to wireless equipment and the way it works. The books do a mediocre job, the schools do a mediocre job. We amateurs are the only ones who really understand how RF really behaves. And so this is a group that gets together and teaches each other how to do that. Let me drop. With enough enthusiasm, the technical net for the last 36 years usually lasts for 4 hours. Starts at 8 p.m. And if there's enough enthusiasm, we go to midnight, 4 hours later. The first section of the TechNet is where people sign in because they do have a question or a comment. You need not sign in just because you're listening. After 35 or 36 years, we believe somebody is listening. 1982, September, is when this TechNet began. It's been around for many thousands of hours. The total number of hours the TechNet's been on the air is greater than the number of hours that Johnny Carson was on the air. So it's got a lot of history. The TechNet, every one of the TechNets for the last 11 years have been recorded. And you can go to the website of Mike Perry, KC2NJI. And that's at, all of a sudden I've forgotten the call letters. KC2WGB. No, that's the guy who used to do it. Can somebody tell me what the call letters? What's the email address? Well, there's two email addresses. One is limarktechnet.com. That's for mic number two. And mic number one is amateurradio.tangovictor. So you go to amateurradio.tangovictor, and you'll find the last 10 or 11 years of the TechNet. You choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and you can play back each one of these one-hour reels and listen to the past issues of the TechNet. The second section of the TechNet, let me drop. After people sign in with a question and answer period, which lasts for approximately 1 hour, depending on enthusiasm and the number of questions, it can be twice that long or half that long. But the second section is where Dr. Roy, AC2, Gulf Sierra, tells us the latest in science and technology, physics. The third section after that is run by Paul, WS2N, who's called the Space Report. And he tells us what's the latest things that have been going on with National Aeronautics and Space Administration, as well as the many other nations that have the equivalent. This will be TechNet number 1703. The Space Report will be Space Report number 303. The Science and Physics Report will be Science and Physics Report number 33. So right now we're going to take sign-in. So please give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. And try to remember to wait for the four beeps in between each transmission. Otherwise, the machine will time out. Let's see if we've got the eastern portion of the machine is working very well. So give me your call letters and name after the beeps right now. K2RIW.
VHYY Joe, yes.
Okay, that was a triple, but I heard Joe. Was the other one OGB? Give me your call letters and name, K2RIW.
I was AC2IS. I don't know if I doubled with somebody else.
AA2GES, Bob, yes.
Okay, we got AC2IS. Let's see. Mr. Burns, we got him. We got AA2GES, I think it is, Bob. And before that, we had WH2RYY Joe. Is anyone else to sign in? Anyone else to sign in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
KD2OGB.
Kilo Delta 2, Oscar Golf Bravo. And your handle, sir?
Name is Craig.
Okay, we got got you, Craig. So we got Joe, AC2IS, AE2GES, and KD2OGB in that order. Anyone else assigning? Give me a call that has a name right now. More than enough to get started. So Joe, W2LYY, how are those electrons treating you on the South Shore tonight? K2LIW listening.
Well, I don't know how the electrons are treating me, but right now I'm trying to watch Channel 13 or scanning the channels, and it's not viewable out here, so something is definitely taking it out. What do you think, Eric? I think I know where it's come from. But my question is this. I've heard you speak about antennas by adjusting the radiation resistance by changing the length and then matching the impedance to get the antenna's impedance to match correctly to your operating system. At the end of the day, by doing it that way, comparing to simply adjusting the antenna length in your system as you do commercially for the best return loss on your operating frequency, at the end of the day, is there any major difference in radiated signal strength of those two respective systems running the same power? Back to you, Dick.
Okay, Joe, you've misquoted me. My original quote was, if you look at the those two sets of curves, all of a sudden I can't think of the guy's name, in the first website, amateurradio.tangovictor, you'll find those curves under impedance matching of dipoles, K2RIW, and you'll also find the article under the other website, which is technetlimoc.com. You'll find these two sets of curves. One curve tells you, for the length of the wire of an antenna, what is the resistive component. The other curve tells you what is the reactive component. What I've said often, let me drop. If you adjust nothing but the length of the wire that is your antenna, you can make the resistive component anything between 1 ohm and 1,000 ohms, inclusive, anything in between. If you wanted the resistive component to be 73.15 ohms, you choose the right length, and that curve shows you how to do it, you'll get that exact resistive component. Then the misquote Joe said is after that you then match the impedance. That's not what I said. I'm saying for every length of wire that you choose, for every particular layout of an antenna, you choose a length of wire that gives you the resistive component. 99% of the time there is a reactive component left over. I'm asking you then to cancel the reactive component. If you're adjusting the antenna, if you follow that article by K2RIW, they'll be telling you how to get proper, perfect impedance match of a dipole. You adjust the length, get the resistive component what you want, and if you're adjusting the length on the long side, in other words, because your particular transmission line is lower in impedance than you've adjusted the antenna, say for instance, you've used a 35 ohm coax, so to speak, and if you want 71, you're using 71 ohm coax. You have to make the antenna longer than quarter wave if you're feeding it from one end, or longer than half wave if you're feeding it in the middle as a dipole. You make it longer than half wave, and you will get the impedance up to 73 ohms. Then the antenna will probably have a reactive component that is inductive. By putting a capacitor across the feed point and choosing the capacitor of the right value, you will cancel the reactive component. If you went in the other direction, if you made the antenna too short and it was capacitive, then you'd have to use a shunt inductor, which is a lot more difficult. Let me drop. I'll warn you ahead of time that when you put that capacitor there, and you're doing it in shunt, if you can put the capacitor in series, in one step you'd have it made. However, mechanically speaking, to put a capacitor in series with an antenna like a monopole is mechanically difficult. To put a shunt capacitor there from an antenna to the ground plane, so to speak, is very easy. So therefore, making the antenna inductive and canceling it with a shunt capacitor is very easy. And the shunt capacitor can be a gimmick capacitor. In other words, it's a piece of copper foil, and by bending the copper foil with a long piece of a wooden stick, you can change the capacitance, and you're watching with your standing wave ratio meter, your antenna analyzer, or your network analyzer, and you're adjusting the capacitor until the inductance goes away. The shunt capacitor does the job beautifully, but it has a slight interaction. The capacitor will slightly readjust the resistive component. By readjusting the length again, you get the resistive component back. So you have one or two more steps to the process. It all takes place in 1 minute, so it really doesn't matter. So you're not adjusting the impedance, you're canceling the reactance in the second step. But now you choose whatever diameter of wire you like. Let me drop. The radiator itself, where you're adjusting the length to get the resistive component that you want. It could be a wide piece of copper tape. It could be a thick wire. It could be a skinny wire. It could be a wire that's got zigzags to it. Whatever you like mechanically, for whatever reason. You adjust that length, you'll eventually get the resistive component exactly what you want. And by the simple process of a shunt capacitor, most of the time, you'll make the reactive component disappear. So does that make a little bit more sense, Joe? And by the way, you want the impedance to equal the impedance of whatever transmission line you're using. Then, in theory, whatever power you put on that transmission line, every bit of it gets radiated. So it's an impedance matching phenomenon. Now, many an amateur wants the standing wave ratio to be 1.0001 to 1, if you know what I mean. He wants it to be very close to unity. Let me drop. And that's a nice goal, but there are times when people misunderstand what's going on and really take it too far. A 2-to-1 standing wave ratio will take almost every one of us and put horror on your face, and you're going to have trouble sleeping at night because your antenna's got a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. Under the worst case conditions, a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio loses you less than half a dB of potential transmitted power. Less than half a dB of loss at 2-to-1. By this adjustment procedure I've just described, you can easily get down to 1.1, where the amount of loss you've got because of reflection from the antenna is so small that without precise laboratory equipment, it's very difficult to measure. Half a dB of loss, by the way, I think is something in the vicinity of 10% of the power, potential power loss. So, is some of that helpful, Joe? W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the tech net.
Of course, it's always helpful. Why am I not coming out of my other radio here? Of course it's helpful, but you're not answering directly the question that I asked you. Using, say, the RIW method, as you described, compared to maybe my method of simply adjusting the antenna length to get the best, the highest return loss figure, negative return loss figure, on your operating frequency. At the end of the day, is there any difference between the way I would do it, as I just said, or the way you would do it as far as radiated signal strength, given we're running the same amount of power at a given distance from the antenna? Would there be a great difference or not?
When you're adjusting nothing but the length, Joe, by way of the Brown and Woodward curves that I just described, you can see how fast the resistive component is changing. You can see how fast the reactive component is changing. 99% of the time, the resistive component and the reactive component do not do exactly what you desire by adjusting nothing but length. Those two parameters, the resistive component and the reactive component, are independent of each other. You can adjust the length to make the reactance go to zero. We call that the resonance. But the resistive component might be 35 ohms if it's a ground plane, if it's a quarter wave ground plane antenna. If you adjust it for the best resistive component to be 50 ohms, then you're going to have an inductive reactance left over. When I'm tuning it with nothing but length, which is better, to have a mismatch of the resistive component or the mismatch of the reactive component? You're going to get a mismatch of at least one of those 90-some-odd% of the time. In either case, you're getting reflected power. On some antennas, making the resistive component perfect is pretty close. In some antennas, making the reactive component perfect is pretty close. On almost all antennas, you will not hit the ideal resistive and reactive component simultaneously unless you follow the procedure that I've described. If you follow the procedure, you're going to have no reflected power from the antenna. If you follow the procedure you described, nothing but length, There's going to be some leftover resistive error. There's going to be some leftover reactive error, one or the other or both. And you'll get a good match, not a perfect match. By following the procedure I described, you can make the match perfect. You have the the resources, Joe, to make it perfect.
Repeater, timeout.
You can decide not to use the perfect procedure if you want to. But now that you know it's there, you'll know what resources you're denying to yourself. W2RYY, KQRIW.
Spoken like a true engineer.
Right. Okay. Still answering the question. Maybe I'm just not getting the question across to you. But if you would take a signal strength reading of the way you would do it compared to the way I would do it, which simply would be adjusting the length of the antenna on the operating frequency to give the minimum amount of reflective power on the operating frequency, it may not be perfect. But at the end of the day, would there be a major difference or a minor difference in the radiated signal strength between the way you do it and the way I would choose to do it? Yes or no?
Yes or no.
Go on to the next guy.
And by the way, if you're adjusting the lens for the greatest radiated power, in the real world, because every environment you and I are likely to be in, because we don't own a perfect anechoic chamber that operates at our frequencies, there's going to be multipath reflection from the ground, the downspout tubing from the house, the wiring of the house, the swing set from the kids in the backyard. There's all kinds of things that are reflecting signal. You're adjusting the length of the antenna using some kind of remote field strength meter, and you're trying to make the field strength maximum. It is a very coarse way of tuning things. At certain lengths, you're going to have certain desirable multipath reflection, which might be still a pretty high standing wave ratio. So if you're adjusting the length for minimum reflected power from the antenna, best standing wave ratio, when you're measuring with a antenna analyzer, the antenna, and you're adjusting nothing but length, you'll get pretty close. You'll never get perfect. With the procedure, you can make it perfect. Which is better? Without a doubt, the procedure is better. Your real question is how much better? Maybe it's 3% of the time, maybe it's 5% better. It is some percentage better. You can do it and make it better if you want to. You can say, hey, I want to do it nothing but the simple way of doing...
Repeater, timeout.
You can say, I want to keep it simple, I want to do nothing but adjusting the length. That's your choice. Okay, the next guy on the list was Bill, AC2IS. A man who just came back from a picnic, I think. AC2IS, KQRIW. Go ahead, Bill.
Yes, just packed back from a picnic yesterday. Just recovering from, all that exposure to shade. Still too much sunlight for me. I asked a question about speakers and how that might relate to antennas, if there's sort of an analog to this particular type of speaker in antennas. In relation to the previous question, just wanted to relate the story of how you helped out Jesse, a friend of mine, with circularly polarized antennas. And he was able to make his antennas so that they were slightly more inductive than they should have been. And then he used an epoxy to hold the antenna together. So the epoxy gave a capacitive effect. So he would sort of continue to add epoxy until he got the SWR ratio he was looking for. Let me break for a moment. I've recently seen a video about a guy constructing speakers that are made out of just sort of straight sheets of rigid plastic that are suspended from fishing wire so that they can hang freely and have nothing interfere with them. And then with double-sided tape, instead of a voice coil like on a paper speaker cone, there's an equivalent exciter, which is sort of moving a weight back and forth, and you use double-sided tape to stick this to the plastic sheet. They recommend placement of the exciter on the plastic sheet. Somewhere, if you divide the sheet up into five equal parts, put it two parts in, so it's a two-fifths mark, rather than having it dead center. And also having a square material and having horizontal and vertical dimensions be different. The reasoning behind that is that with a straight piece of plastic, when you resonate it like this, with this exciter, you have some prominent frequencies where you get a lot of resonance and other frequencies where there's not so much resonance. So then they add this additional feature where they take the remaining area, they put the exciter in a two-fifths position, and then they take the remaining area on each side of that exciter, and they divide that up into two, five parts. And at the two-fifths part, they add, instead of another exciter, they add a weight. And they find that by adding weights at these positions, they create multiple peaks, resonance peaks in this material, and also peaks that are less prominent. So they get a more level frequency response. I hope I have not timed out the repeater. Let me break.
And can you tell us the source of this article that you're describing? Go right ahead, Bill.
It was a YouTube channel, and I would have to look it up. This is the exciter. I recall the cost being something like $8. The sheets of plastic could be, you know, very cheap stuff. They also recommend for better performance and lower frequencies, I think balsa wood, which could also be very cheap stuff. And they were, with the proper attention, they were getting performance out of these that rivaled some very high-end speaker systems. I think that they said it did not cover a range that you would normally use a subwoofer for, but otherwise very good performance, very low power consumption for the amount of sound that you got out of it. The question is, do you think there's an equivalent of this in antennas? What would be the equivalent of, I guess the two-fifths position of the exciter would be the equivalent of a feed point, but also they put these weights on the antenna, on the speaker, on the sheet of plastic that they were resonating at the speaker, at these specific points. And I was wondering if you're doing something like that or attempting to do something like that in an antenna, what would that look like? What would you be adding at that two-fifths position? AC2IS.
And before I proceed, Bill, if we are going to find this on YouTube, what is the search word you used for this flat sheet speaker or something like that? What was the search word that allowed you to find this on YouTube?
I don't know if I've described the situation adequately. The video was kind of long, but I'm going to try to find it again. In the meantime, I wonder if there's any comment you could give, AC2IS.
Yes, there is. The speed of sound in air is approximately 1,000 feet per second. Therefore, a 1 kc note in air is approximately 1 foot long. A 10 kc note is a little bit longer than an inch. So once you know the speed of sound in air, the loudspeaker starts making some more sense to you. You now know why a woofer that's going to go down to, let me say, 100 hertz, where the wavelength is around 10 feet, you can see how you'd like to have a great big cone to move that much air and to issue the sound efficiently. A 10 kc note, where the sound has a wavelength of a little bit more than 1 inch, you put a 10 kc note into a speaker that's really a woofer, a great big large speaker, like, you know, something 6 inches in diameter. It would be six wavelengths in diameter. And if you could see it with a high-speed camera, as a stroboscope, so to speak, you'd probably see individual portions of that 6-inch diameter speaker moving independently, moving like waves. And now you know how a 6-inch diameter speaker doesn't make a very good tweeter. Let me drop. So knowing the speed of sound in air and wavelengths, which you can easily calculate, helps a little bit. These weights that you're putting in certain places on your flat sheet of speaker, you're exciting it, you're pushing it and pulling it, and other places you're putting weights to act as a damper, and they are probably the equivalent of a capacitor. If it was an antenna, you could have a piece of wire that's a certain length that gives you a certain resonant frequency, and at specific places, if this was a beverage-like antenna, which is parallel, a piece of wire parallel to the ground, at specific places along the wire, you could add a capacitor between the wire and a grounding rod, so to speak, and that would act as local capacitive loading points, which would give you specific resonances of your wire if that's what you desired. If you desired to make a particular antenna pattern by having certain amplitude and certain phase angles of the signal going down your wire, ordinarily, a beverage antenna or a rhombic antenna is a traveling wave signal antenna. In other words, the signal goes down the wire once, hits the far end, gets absorbed, and gives you a lot of gain in one direction. Eliminate the loading resistor at the far end, and whatever signal is left over reflects back, and you now disturb the front-to-back ratio. So it independently radiates a certain amount of signal forward and a certain amount of signal backwards, and you can control that by how much reflection you've set up on the wire. Acoustically, there are kinds of resonance. The so-called bass reflex speaker system uses some of these characteristics by adjusting the acoustic length of the portion of the signal that's behind the speaker and where it's allowed to come back out and how big is the horn that issues the signal coming back out. You can control the pattern, you can control the phase, therefore you can make the bass reflex signal, bass reflex enclosure, favor certain frequencies. Let me drop. And now the rate at which the signal propagates down your piece of plastic, I am guessing, is not too different from depending on how thick the plastic is and what it's made out of. But under certain conditions, the rate at which the signal propagates down the plastic might not be a whole lot faster or slower than the way the signal propagates through air. So these things help. It's far from the whole story. The nice thing about the speaker you're describing is the materials are not expensive. There's all kinds of ways you can do a whole bunch of trial and error experiments and eventually come up with a combination that you like. And apparently this person who produced this YouTube video did just that. He's probably spent 5 or 10 hours tweaking this thing before he got the particular results he liked. Let me drop. And at first I thought you were about to describe the capacitive loudspeaker. There's a way of taking two sheets of metal and mounting them very close to each other. Put a pretty high voltage bias between the two, a few thousand volts, and then put an audio signal superimposed on those two capacitor plates that are close to each other. And as the peak voltage gets higher, you get electrostatic attraction. As the peak voltage gets lower, you don't. And therefore, you can make a very large speaker that's quite efficient, where the actual loudspeaker itself is this great big flat sheet of material that's not connected to anything. It's just suspended by the four corners, so to speak. So a capacitive speaker, I don't know the exact words they use for it, but that can be properly set up. It can be very broadband, very low in resonance phenomena, and rather high in performance. Over to you, Bill. AC2IS, K2LIW in the TechNet. Drag your feet in case we have other speaker experts who can give us more direct knowledge on this one. Over to Bill with some delay.
Okay, thanks, Dick. I seem to have some difficulty with my internet connection right now, so I'm not able to name the YouTube channel that I got this information from. But I guess my next question was going to be, okay, if you could add capacitors and they would be the equivalent of adding these weights to the sheet of plastic, would there be a reason, I guess you'd be able to use this antenna, if you did this, over a wider range of frequencies. But then it's peak performance at any given frequency would be, you know, not nearly as good as something that has been optimized for a particular frequency. This does not seem very useful to me, but maybe you would know of some reason why this would be useful. If you can think of an application, please let me know. AC2IF.
Yeah, I was doing a very simple comparison of this audio loudspeaker-like thing that you're describing versus a beverage antenna. A beverage antenna built in a pure manner, which is a piece of wire parallel to the ground, maybe 10 feet off the ground, and it goes for a large number of wavelengths. In the ideal world, you'd like to make it 10 wavelengths long, and it's an extremely broad band antenna in its original way of construction. It can easily cover 80 through 10 meters if you've got enough property to set this thing up correctly, with a slight increase in gain as you go higher in frequency. Now, by hanging capacitive loading devices along that piece of wire, you can change the velocity of propagation, you can make it favor certain frequencies as opposed to being broadband, and you can adjust the antenna pattern. It would be a great big trial and error process, which could be done very nicely with a computer modeling program. So this acoustic thing has some of those characteristics. An ideal loudspeaker, I guess, would be a very large sheet of metal driven close to one end. The far end would have some kind of an acoustic damping device, and so that your sound wave would be traveling down your sheet of plastic, in your case, and radiating the signal as it goes. But I can see a problem now. If the sheet of plastic at some of your operating audio frequencies is multiple wavelengths long, you're going to get some standing waves. To make the thing really broadband, you'd like to move the whole sheet simultaneously. And that's what the capacitive speaker system does. It moves the whole sheet simultaneously in one great big motion, because the amount of capacitance per square inch is the same in the center as it is at the corners, as it is at the diagonals, and so on. So the capacitive speaker system, properly set up, can be an extremely...
Repeater, timeout.
It can be an extremely broadband, fairly high in efficiency speaker system, because only the capacitive loading energy that you're putting into this system is being converted into a sound wave. And properly set up, there is no resistive loss anywhere, so to speak, so it can be extremely efficient. And this thing that you're describing is not quite like that. It's a nice, interesting acoustic experiment. I'm having doubts about this being an ideal way to build a speaker that's going to give you high power output, broad bandwidth. You would like an acoustic speaker to be extremely broadband. You don't want it to have resonances, because any place that has got resonance, it's going to sound tubby, as they say. Over to you, Bill. By the way, to the guy who's got this YouTube audio article, loudspeaker article, did he claim that this is just an interesting experiment, or did he claim that this is an ideal speaker and we should all be doing this? AC2IS, K2LIW, wait for the beat.
This guy was relating his own experiences. I think that his opinion was that for a pretty minimal investment, you could get some pretty high-performing speakers. The trade-off would be the amount of time that you'd have to invest, your own time. So I don't think he's expecting that, quote-unquote, everybody will be doing this. On the other hand, if you're an audiophile and if the room that you're working with, you know, would meet the requirements of the system, these speakers, I think, you know, people for audiophiles are probably willing to dedicate a lot of space to their speakers. These speakers are, you know, very thin, but they're also very large. They don't have to be very large, but I guess part of the advantage here is that you can make them very large and, you know, get some good performance because of the size of your speakers, right? It would not cost you a whole lot to to get something, I think 4x8 would be excessive, but, you know, pretty large. You could get 4x8 sheets of plastic. You could cut it down to whatever size you wanted. You could get flat sheets of balsa. You could cut that down to whatever size you wanted. So I think probably he's expecting that only people who are interested in spending a lot of time on optimizing their speaker setup would do this, but that they would be able to do it for very low cost, AC2IS.
Now, Bill, the prime mover for this thing, the actuator, what was it, what did it cost, what does it look like? The thing that does the pushing and pulling, you put the signal into that thing. What is it called and what does it cost? Go ahead.
My recollection is that it was referred to as a quote-unquote exciter. It was a very small, not very thick, not, you know, it was a round-ish kind of device. And there were four feet on it that you would that you would tape using double-sided tape to whatever. I mean, one of the things that they suggested would be easy to do that you'd get like relatively good performance out of is sort of a, if you've got like a bathroom door or whatever door in your house that's hollow, that you could double-sided tape this. And if you wanted a quick experiment, you could just sort of take your finger and push it up against the door without taping it and get a sense of what it would sound like. I don't know if that's an adequate description. Cost, I believe, was an estimated $8 per exciter, AC2IS.
This is KD2HJV.
Sounds like KD2HJV. Go right ahead, sir. Give me your name.
It's Kilo Delta 2, Hotel Julia Papa, the name here is Charlie. I just caught part of this conversation, but I believe you're speaking of a tactile transducer, which is basically a solenoid, which is exciting any surface that you're placing the transducer again. So basically, it's a push-pull motor that vibrates a large sheet over you.
Yeah, thank you, Charlie. That's quite helpful. That's what I was going to guess also, that it's really a magnetic solenoid assembly. There's a strong relationship between loudspeakers and a phased array antenna. Before you guys got into ham radio, but way back in the dark ages, there was something called the Sweet 16 speaker. Barry Green Sheets or Edley Electronics or the Tandy Company. Somebody in the dark ages used to sell very inexpensive small loudspeakers, something like 2-inch diameter loudspeakers. And if you bought 16 of these things, the 2-inch diameter loudspeaker worked pretty well from 1 KC and above. But if you bought 16 of them, and they weren't very expensive, and you mounted them on a large sheet, 4 wide, 4 high, and fed them in such a way that they're all being fed in phase, so that you get these 16 individual loudspeakers, all moving in unison, it acted like a very big woofer, and it was an extremely broadband, very good sounding speaker system for not very much price. So I'd much rather see somebody construct a Sweet 16 out of loudspeakers than this experiment that you're describing, Bill. What you're describing is a nice experiment to give you some of the hands-on experience. Let me drop it. You'll get some hands-on experience of learning some of the acoustic properties of loudspeaker-like things. But the chances of making a high-performance broadband loudspeaker in that manner, I think, is very low. I'd much rather see a person build something like a Sweet 16, if you know what I mean. Find some kind of small, inexpensive speakers, buy a whole lot of them, test each one with your ohmmeter to make sure that they all move in the same direction when you put the same polarity on them. So whether you're feeding them all in series or in parallel or series-parallel combinations, make sure they all move in phase. And by the way, you can do some other experiments by putting some of them out of phase. But if you make sure they all move in phase, you can now make a make a whole door into a loudspeaker, if you know what I mean, and with very high performance. So I wonder if you've ever heard of the Sweet 16, Bill. I'd much rather see you do that experiment, because now you're starting off with something that is known to have a performance, not too expensive, except that it doesn't go down low enough in frequency, and by putting a whole bunch of them in parallel on a large sheet of material, stiff material, you now synthesize a great big woofer. The woofer itself doesn't have broad frequency response. The woofer needs some kind of a trade-off low-pass, high-pass filter network to feed the high signals to the tweeters, and the low frequencies to the tweeter, to the woofer, and the medium-sized frequencies to the mid-sized speakers. Let me drop. I think they call that a crossover network. In the case of the Sweet 16, no crossover network is required. You just take your signal, properly wired, to the 16 speakers. Maybe you can start off with four of them, and then made 16 later. And if you really want to get enthusiastic, use 32 or 64 of them. And you can make a woofer that goes down to 10 hertz with very high performance, all the way up to 10 or 20 kilohertz. AC2IS for any final comments. K2LAW, go ahead, Bill.
VDH with a comment.
VDH, start off with your name and then your comment, sir. Mr. VDH, go ahead. Okay, we do have the Eastern repeater. Mr. VDH, one more time, K2LAW. Maybe he'll come back later. So, I wonder if you've ever heard of the Sweet 16, Bill. AC2IS, K2LAW.
I have not heard of the Sweet 16. I wonder how it is that ganging up the small speakers can get you low woofer performance. You know, the claim, let's see, the YouTube channel is called Tech Ingredients. I was able to find that by searching, flat DIY speakers. The $8 device is called an 8-ohm exciter, and I think it's called, I think it's available at DigiKey under the name PUI Audio Exciter. But this guy feels that with a couple different materials, he's able to get very good, he's able to get excellent performance, he claims, from like plexiglass, combination of plexiglass and balsa wood. And he says that he does not need any crossover network to get this, but just drives them independently. Seems to work out very well. And he gets very good, volume compared to power input. But he also suggests that for even cheaper, you get pretty good mid-range performance, not quite as good on the high end, not quite as good on the low end, just with a particular type of cardboard. I think he called it a hex cell cardboard. So a very cheap material that you can get, very good performance out of compared to, average setups. Versus, going to two separate types of material to get what he refers to as very high-end performance, just the frequencies you get out of a subwoofer, which is, again, typical for other systems. AC2IS.
K2HK, do you have a comment?
Go ahead, Charlie.
As an aside, two comments, actually. The transducers that you're speaking of are actually going to be becoming more common now. They're going to be using them in flat screen displays, in televisions, in kiosks, and things like that where speakers are not normally. They're obtrusive, they take up too much space, and now they're going to put the drivers behind the flat screen TVs and make it kind of seamless. That's one. Number two, line-driven arrays, regardless of a cool little setup. The problem with these little drivers is they're not very efficient. Let's drop. Yeah, they're not very efficient, and they need juice to drive them. And even though you're going to spread it out across a number of transducers to get the movement that you require, you're going to need a lot of oomph to get there. And the more oomph you need, the detail starts to become fuzzy. Over to you.
We're hearing you very well, Charlie, but your audio is quite low, so whenever you come back to us, do shout into that microphone. And this guy who has this flat do-it-yourself speaker system on YouTube, and he said it sounds pretty good, or he implies that, that's very qualitative. That's a very qualitative statement. I'd love to have him do a swept frequency response. In other words, with a really flat microphone sitting some distance in front of the thing and feeding a sine wave into it that slowly sweeps from low frequencies to high frequencies, I think you're going to find out he's got all kinds of peaks and valleys and suckouts. In the case of a woofer that you want to go down to 100 hertz, that woofer is going to be something like 12, 14, 16 inches in diameter. It's got to move a lot of air, because a 100 hertz wave in air has a wavelength of 10 feet. And so you'd like your loudspeaker to be a fraction of a wavelength in diameter in order to efficiently launch that audio signal into air. By way of the Sweet 16, even though you're using individual small speakers, because you've got a whole lot of them stacked together, four wide and four high, and they're all moving in unison, you are synthesizing a large cone of a woofer or a subwoofer. So that's how it can have very good response, even though the individual speakers appear not to have that much response. The individual speakers are such a small fraction of a wavelength at 100 hertz that not very much sound comes out of them. But you make a phased array of them with 16 or 32 of them, and you're going to be moving a hell of a lot more air, 16 to 32 times more air, and that's not even counting the fact that they cross-couple a little bit. You're even moving more air than that. You can, the Sweet 16 approach can give you a very broadband, non-crossover speaker system, and I think in bang for dollar, let me drop it. In other words, the number of hours and number of dollars you invest versus the performance you're going to get, I think you're going to have a lot more fun with the Sweet 16. So my guess is, if you Google the word Sweet 16 speaker system, even though it was an article of 30 years ago, because it was so successful in its day, guarantee somebody's got an article somewhere describing how to do it and how well it works. So if you go through with this experiment, Bill, let us know how it works. I think it's something that you can spend a lot of hours and only get partial performance, because what you're trying to do by the method you're describing is very difficult. To make a, if this is the world's best speaker system, the cone would be large in diameter so that it can go down to very low frequencies. The cone would be extremely light so that it's easy to move at high frequencies, and it would be extremely stiff so that individual portions don't bend when you're at the high frequencies. Well, there's no, a material like that doesn't exist, that's simultaneously large, stiff, and light. Therefore, you've got woofers, mid-range speakers, and tweeters. But by way of the Sweet 16 approach, you can have your cake and eat it too, if you know what I mean. I'm going to go on to the next person, Bob. Alpha Alpha 2 Golf Echo Sierra, I think it is. Bob, you've got it. K2LIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick. It's actually Kilo Alpha 2 Golf Echo Foxtrot, and the name is Bob. Yeah, I went from my radio, my portable, to my phone because I wasn't getting in well with the radio. My question today is, I want to put up a 6-meter repeater. I'm looking around for cavities. I used to have one cavity many years ago because I worked at that time for a paging company, and I had this, when they closed, the guy says, do you want to take this 7-foot can home? I said, yeah. I've had it for many years, but then I had to get rid of it. My wife said it's taking up too much space in the garage, and at that time I wasn't going to go into 6. Let me drop it for a second. Okay, so anyway, now I am prepared to do it, and I cannot find any cans, but I did find an article from many years ago on putting up making a 6-meter duplexer from 1 7/8 hard line. What other means can I do it? By cross banding, or can I use the internet? Up for suggestions.
WHY, what a comment.
Go ahead, Joe.
I don't know if they still make them, but quite a few years ago, Phelps Dodge, which is now called RFS, so they became SOWIV and RFS up in Connecticut, did have a 6-meter duplexer. I think they had either a 4 or 6 can version that was tunable up to like 50 megahertz, maybe even higher. The problem is it's a lot of money. It's like about $4,000.
Bob, on a quick break, the cavity that you used to own that you had to get rid of, which was 7 foot tall, what was the diameter of that cavity? Over to you, Bob.
It was 10 inches in diameter and 7 feet tall. I believe the frequency was somewhere around, we were paging 47 or 43, I'm not sure. It was in that ballpark, but it could have been tuned to 6 meters, I found out, by speaking to TXRX at that time.
Every cavity resonator really is some kind of transmission line. It could be a piece of waveguide, in other words, no center conductor, but most of the time, it's really a transmission line with a center conductor. Usually shorted at one end, open at the other end. Electronically, it's a quarter wavelength long. That's where the resonance comes from. So if you want a high-Q cavity resonator, and you want 4 or 6 of them in order to make a good 6-meter repeater duplexer, you'd like each of these things to have very low insertion loss. The nice thing about 6 meters, 50 megacycles, is that transmission lines like 7/8 inch hard line and 1 5/8 hard line automatically have very low loss at 50 megacycles, because that cable is really made to work at 450 megacycles. Let me drop. So making your individual resonators homebrew out of 7/8 inch or 1 5/8 Andrew Heliax is a very desirable thing to do. 6 meters is what? 18 feet, quarter wavelength of 18 feet is what? 6 feet? Let me think. No, 4/6 is it. I got a calculator here, so I'll find out real fast. But some reasonable number of feet is the length of the cavity resonator. It doesn't have to be one straight piece. You can make it into a U-shape. You can put elbows in it, if you know what I mean. A pair of right-angle bends, which can be homebrewed. You don't want to buy the right-angle bends in 1 5/8 or 7/8 inch Andrew Heliax. They're probably very expensive. But you can homebrew them with chunks of copper and a good soldering iron. So the cavity resonator at 6 meters doesn't have to be 6 foot tall. You can make it 3 foot tall by folding it back on itself. And that'll have very little effect as far as the Q of the cavities and therefore the performance. So, when there are a number of articles, let me drop it. There are a significant number of articles in the right references which will tell you how to build a homebrew duplexing filter or system. And considering what, because it's such a rare item, you would have to spend an awful lot of dollars to buy one commercially made, ready to roll. If you've got a great big ham club like this one, yeah, you write the check and the problem goes away. But you're probably doing this, as most of our ham operations are, on a shoestring. And therefore, you're willing to spend some elbow grease instead of dollars in order to homebrew it yourself. So to homebrew it out of 1 5/8 or 7/8 inch Andrew Heliax, very doable. And you can make it compact by folding it back or making it into a great circle. There's all kinds of ways you can make it more compact. Once you understand the theory of operation of a duplexing filter, to homebrew it and give it enough performance that you desire is quite doable. Let me drop. And there's one other thing you should consider before you lock in this design, and that is there's nothing magic about your repeater all operating from one single antenna. With a duplexing filter, yes, one filter can do it. One antenna can do it. But now you need 120, 130 decibels of isolation in that duplexing filter between the transmit frequency and the receive frequency. If you don't have 120 dB of isolation and low insertion loss on the pass frequencies, if you don't have that combination, then you're going to have a lot of descent problems. So to tune the filter is a bit of an art form, even after you've properly homebrewed it. If you're willing to make a split-site repeater, in other words, the transmitting antenna and the receiving antenna are either vertically displaced on the same tower or they're mounted on a slightly different tower. There's a huge advantage when you do that because the first 80 dB of isolation comes from the separation of the two antennas, the transmitting antenna and the receiving antenna. And all of a sudden, the requirement of the duplexing filter becomes very easy as opposed to quite hard. So do consider a split-site repeater. And on 6 meters, it's relatively easy to do, in my opinion, Bob. KA2, is it KD2GES, Golf Echo Foxtrot. Kilo Alpha 2, Golf Echo Foxtrot. I'm having trouble reading my own writing here, Bob. K2IW, you got it, Bob.
Okay. That's my other option, and my daughter lives a couple of miles away from me. And I spoke to her today, and she said she would have no problem with me putting an antenna, receiving antenna, at her house. And I would have be, because she's not licensed, I would be the transmitting antenna at my house, because I have the license. I don't know if the link, all right, to link them, I could use 220 or 900, no, yeah, 900 I think I can use. It's short, it's only 4 miles. And now, if she hits at the receive site and she's not licensed, but there is a transmitter, but as long as the transmitter IDs with my call sign, is that legal or what? Back to you, Dick. KA2GES.
I think the answer is yes. I think that is legal, Bob. From your point of view, it's a remote base. With proper identification, as long as you have control over it, it's only going to transmit when it's receiving a signal. And as long as you've got some other way of remotely controlling it, phone line or whatever, that you have the ability to turn it off if something goes bad, then I believe that can be made legal. Eric can probably give us more words on that, but in fact, there's an awful lot of repeaters that have remote receiving sites. And the remote site doesn't necessarily have an operator located there. And yet it's a receiving site with an RF link, a UHF link, back to the voting location for the repeating system. So I know there's ways you can make that legal. And so that's a good approach. And now you've got to weigh the relative advantage and disadvantage. Mechanically, it's nice to have the same transmitting and receiving site where you transmit and receive from one antenna. But now that requires, to really get full performance, it requires a state-of-the-art duplexing filter. And the duplexing filter with all of the performance requirements, the words roll off the tongue very easily. To really carry it out as a homebrew project, you'll spend a good fraction of a year doing it and getting the bugs out of it. As opposed to the split site that you're describing, which can be done quite a bit easier, in my opinion. So, you've got a decision to be made as to what's the right way to go on this one, Bob. Let us know what you decide, and good luck with that project. Back to you for any final. KA2GEF, K2LAW on the TechNet. Go right ahead, Eric.
I was going to say, there's a number of easy ways to make duplexes these days. They make these interlocking slats of aluminum that you can construct a cavity Any shape that you want. Nice and flat. Actually, there's a lot of commercial products that are rectangular in shape. One of the things that I would suggest, because I've done this before, is to do it as a pass-reject duplexer. That you can play a lot of tricks with.